The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony, a very good morning to you.
Boker Tov, nice to talk to you, Chad. Before we get into the news of the day, I was reading a great story which I wanted to share with you guys about the way in which Israeli technology was recently deployed at a mass that was conducted by the Pope. This is back in September when the Pope was on a visit to Slovakia. And the Israeli technology in question is an anti-drone technology. It's something that's used to protect a particular area from rogue drones that might come into that space and potentially cause a security threat, cause any type of threat to the gathering that's happening at that area. And in this particular case in Slovakia, there was in fact a rogue drone that was that had the potential to interrupt this mass that was being held by Pope Francis with something like 60,000 worshippers in Slovakia during his visit there. There were apparently 90 bishops in attendance, 500 priests in attendance at this particular event, as well, of course, as the Pope himself and members of the general public. And we understand that this technology, which is operated by a company called Defend, was deployed by the Slovakian authorities in order to ensure that rogue drones are not would not cause a threat to the gathering that was happening, clearly outdoor gathering on this particular occasion, and it provided this 360 degree coverage. And we understand that there was indeed a potentially a rogue drone that entered the area, and that Defend was able to combat that particular threat. So it's interesting that we live in a world now where part of your security operation has to be making sure that you don't have any rogue drones in the vicinity in order to keep protection, keep proper security over the area. Fascinating story.
Definitely, and I can see me inserting rogue drones into a lot of conversations this coming week. But fortunately, we now know that I can also insert Defend, which is there to protect these gatherings, events, and very important meetings from these rogue drones. I believe that there have been two separate bombing raids in Syria by the Israeli Defense Force. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, so we've spoken during my chats with Howard over many, many months and even many years about attacks that Israel carries out against targets in Syria. It's kind of almost a weekly event, even maybe even more frequent than that, that we hear about attacks being carried out against targets in Syria. We attribute it to Israel. The Syrian press, the general press, attributes this to Israel. The Israeli authorities, as a general rule, never really respond to these attributions and to the, I suppose, accusations, you might even call them. Israel is pretty silent about it, but it seems more likely than not that the source of these attacks would be Israel. And the reason that Israel would attack targets in Syria are numerous. There might be movement of arms and ammunition, weapons, which presented a threat to Israel along that southern border, the Syrian southern border with Israel. There might be movement of troops. There's even been apparent attacks carried out against drone threats, where the Iranians have been particularly active in building out drone capabilities, and that certain drone bases, we understand, have been established in southern Syria, which Israel considers to be a threat to its security. And, of course, most importantly, the presence of Iran in general in that particular region has been apparently a good reason why Israel would carry out attacks. But here is a story that was published yesterday in the Washington Post, and it talks about two particular attacks that were carried out, one near Damascus and one near Homs. Apparently, seven soldiers, including a Syrian colonel, were killed during the course of these attacks that talk about having been carried out in June of this year. And they talk about the fact that these attacks were actually targeted against Syrian chemical weapons facilities. Now, this kind of adds a whole new meaning and a whole new significance to the reason that Israel may be active either in the air or using ground artillery in order to attack bases in Syria. The fact that Syrian chemical weapons facilities existed has not been reported up until now. This is the first time that this particular fact has been exposed to the general public. We know that Syria in the past has had chemical weapons capabilities, and we've even seen Syria use those chemical weapons capabilities during the course of the civil war that's been carried out in Syria over the past decade or so. We understand that during 2013, after there was a massive sarin gas attack carried out by the Syrian army, Syrian regime troops in the course of the civil war, something like 1,400 civilians in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta were actually killed. And we understand that at the time, the then president, the US President Obama, managed somehow to convince the Syrian regime to park their chemical weapons capability and to effectively deactivate it in order to avoid such horrendous scenes being repeated in the future. But now it comes to our attention that apparently Syria has renewed its efforts to produce chemical weapons. And while this presents potentially a threat to those civilians who are not supporters of the Syrian regime, it also potentially presents a threat to Israel, because who knows how the Syrian regime might choose to use these chemical weapons. Apparently, there was discussion about the possibility of the production of sarin gas and also potentially some other chemicals that could be used as part of weaponry. So, different nerve gases. Apparently, there was an identification through intelligence of a stockpile of nerve agents. So this is what apparently caused the Israeli, the IDF, to wish to target those particular facilities. And, you know, what I would say is that the movement of arms and ammunition, the establishment of Iran in a base in southern Syria is probably good enough reason why Israel would want just to interrupt all of that and to prevent the threat, the security threat that would present itself as a result of that. But when you talk about beginning chemical weapon production, I think it just takes on an entirely new meaning, and it gives even greater justification to how active the IDF has been in the airspace in Syria and on the ground in order to prevent such facilities being set up. I'm not quite sure what the current status of that chemical weapons program is, but you can take it as a given that Israel would do everything in its power to prevent any firm establishment of chemical weapon production facility in Syria. That would just be an absolute no in terms of a security threat to Israel.
You mentioned that these bombing raids are fairly frequent. I'm assuming they're well planned and that they are precision attacks. The situation in Syria is deplorable. It's heartbreaking what we've seen come out of there the last few years with the civil war. Do we hear of any collateral damage in these bombing raids, or are they precision attacks?
The IDF as a general rule is very precise in the way that it strikes targets. It has very clear intelligence information about why it's going somewhere, what it intends to do, what the target will look like. The pilots in the air are being fed real-time information, including real-time pictures of what their target looks like and what they should be looking out for from their pilot seat in the air. Pilots are given an absolute discretion over whether they ultimately choose to fire the missile or not, as to whether all the relevant matters are in place to justify the missile being targeted. We've heard of numerous stories where civilians have been specifically purposefully sent to a particular target in the knowledge that if the pilots would see civilians in the area, that they would abort the bombing raid in order to prevent collateral damage. Israeli pilots and the IDF in general has a reputation for being very, very precise to try to avoid collateral damage wherever possible. Having said that, there are reports of collateral damage from time to time. War is dangerous, and unfortunately people get killed, and there are reports of collateral damage. But I think it would be a safe assumption, even though we don't get all the information on every single attack that's carried out, I think it would be a safe assumption that the IDF is doing everything that it possibly can to avoid any civilians getting caught up in the attacks that it carries out.
Moving on, I believe that there is another Middle Eastern leader that is reported to be coming to visit Israel.
Well, potentially, yeah. I mean, we spoke yesterday about Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's visit to the United Arab Emirates. He met with the United Arab Emirates leader, Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. We understand that they had a meeting yesterday that lasted 4 hours. That seems, in my terms in diplomatic speak, to be almost inconceivable that there could be a meeting lasting that length of time between the leaders of two different countries. And not only that the meeting itself carried on for 4 hours, but the fact that half of that time, 2 hours of that time, was actually spent one-on-one between Naftali Bennett and Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. So a very, very fascinating relationship seemingly being formed between the two leaders. The Crown Prince, of course, is de facto leader of the United Arab Emirates, given that his half-brother, who is formerly the leader, formerly the president of the United Arab Emirates, suffered a stroke some years ago. And as a result of that, Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed has become de facto leader, and he's leading all the initiatives, diplomatic initiatives, and effectively the decision maker nowadays in the United Arab Emirates. And we understand that, as amongst other things that were discussed between the two leaders in that lengthy 4 hour session, was the possibility of Sheikh Mohammed coming to Israel. And we understand that he is quite enthusiastic about the possibility of paying a return visit to Israel in order to respond to the invitation that was issued by Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. And in fact, the Prime Minister did issue a video talking about his visit, which he released shortly before he departed back to Israel from Abu Dhabi. I think it's a fascinating watch. It doesn't take very long, but it shows a great deal of optimism, and the Prime Minister uses those words. He says he's very, very optimistic about the relationship that is being formed between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, given bearing in mind that that's such a new relationship. It's only really been formed within the last, formally at least, officially, within the last year or two since the signing of the Abraham Accords. We do know that there was a lot of work that went on in the background for probably decades, without diplomatic relations having been formed, but still work going on at an official level with the knowledge of the two governments in order to try to develop particularly commercial relationships, but indeed other relationships as well. There are many, many common interests that the two countries have in the region. And so it makes imminent sense that they should be countries with close diplomatic relations and close economic ties as well. And that seems to be how things are panning out right now. So from all that we can see, and in particular from that video, which listeners can watch quite easily on YouTube, we get the impression that has been a very, very successful 2 days for the Prime Minister in Abu Dhabi.
It's amazing to hear about the rewards that are now being reaped in respect of the fact that all this back-channeling has been taking place for so many years that culminated in the Abraham Accords, and we now seen the fruits of those labors. Moving from politics to religion, I believe today is the fast day of the 10th of Tevet.
Yeah, so the 10th of Tevet is one of the minor fast days in the Jewish calendar, of course, the Israeli calendar as well, but specifically the Jewish calendar. And just the same as most of Jewish festivals surround the notion of they try to kill us, we survive, let's eat. It seems as if though most of the fast days surround the issue of the destruction of the temple, of destruction of Jerusalem, of the capture of Jerusalem. And the 10th of Tevet is no exception, because that is the day on which it is understood or believed that there was a major event in taking siege in Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia, an event that ultimately led to the destruction of Solomon's temple, of course, the first temple, and the downfall of the kingdom of Judea. And as a result of that, we have a fast day today, the 10th of Tevet. However, it has a greater significance than simply marking the moment where the siege of Jerusalem began, and which ultimately ended in the destruction of the temple. It has also been adopted by the Israeli government and the chief rabbinate in Israel as what they call the Yom HaKadish HaKlali, the general Kaddish day. And this is the day which is really used to commemorate the memories, particularly the victims of the Shoah, of those people of whose date of death we are unaware. People will be generally aware that you have a Yahrzeit, you have a memorial day, which is the anniversary of the Hebrew date of the death of that particular individual. But in the case of so many of the victims of the Shoah, we don't know their dates. And in fact, many of them don't even have a place of burial, somewhere where we can go and mourn them, where we can commemorate their memories. And so the chief rabbinate of Israel chose to use today, the 10th of Tevet, as the Yom HaKadosh HaKlali, in order to allow those people who wish to memorialize those family members who perished in the Shoah, today's your day to say Kaddish, to light your candle, to say your Mishnayot, whatever is generally your practice on a day of memorial to the memory of victims of people, the memory of those people who have passed on in, before you. And the reason that this day has been chosen rather than a day which one would think is logical being Yom HaShoah, which is a day that follows, closely follows Pesach, is that Yom HaShoah actually falls in the month of Nisan. And the month of Nisan in the Hebrew calendar generally is a month in which mourning is prohibited. And so it seems slightly contradictory to create a Yom HaKadosh HaKlali during a month where mourning is generally prohibited anyway. And it is for that reason that today, the 10th of Tevet, has been chosen as the Yom HaKadosh HaKlali. I'm aware of the fact that certain people even hold Yom Kippur as the day upon which they say Kaddish to the memory of those people who perished in the Shoah and whose date of death is unknown. I think everybody should follow their own practices to do whatever they've been accustomed to doing. But just to know that today is definitely an option, and it is a very, very widespread custom, in Israel at least, to say Kaddish to the memory of those who perished in the Shoah. So let's just use today to reflect upon that, and to potentially, for those of us who've had family members who perished in the Shoah, to also use this as a memorial day to their memories as well.
Anthony Reich, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to our next conversation.